The last four sermons now, I've been giving a series on the Exodus. My goal here has not been to focus on all the details, but to get more of an overall picture, a flow of the way things were happening, more or less establishing kind of a time frame for what was going on. We started with the children of Israel in slavery here in Exodus. We've looked through the scriptures, and it took a combining of both Exodus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy to kind of put all it together. But we found out that there were a lot of things we really don't know, like exactly where is the mountain of God. And we looked at various alternatives. We also looked at various alternatives about where the crossing was. They crossed the Gulf of Suez, crossed the Gulf of Aqaba. Was the mountain of God down here in the Sinai Peninsula, the traditional area? Was it up here somewhere in Midian? Which it seems like to me that it might be a better case made for that than for the Sinai. But we don't know for sure. But anyway, we looked at the paths that the Israelites might have taken for either location. And then we begin to look at what happened once they got to the mountain of God. And that is about where we were. We know that there were problems once they got to the mountain of God shortly before Pentecost. They received the Ten Commandments, God speaking from the mountain, probably a tremendous display to have seen that. But then problems. And we didn't spend a lot of detail on the problems, but you have to kind of feel sorry for Moses. He went up there, fasted for 40 days, 40 nights, got the commandments, got all the laws, come down. You know, there they are, the golden calf. He has to go back up. Now he fasts another 40 days and nights. And so he also will be fasting another 40 days and nights before they get to Canaan the first time. The poor guy must have been skin and bones. All he was doing was fasting, it seems like. So, but I had never thought about this much until I prepared this last sermon that I gave. They spent an awfully long time at the mountain of God. They got there around Pentecost, and as I closed the sermon last time, they didn't leave till around the beginning of the second year. So, you know, it only took them a month or so to get out of Egypt and to the mountain of God, and then it took the rest of a year before they actually left. And we don't know a lot about what was going on during that time. But they did leave, and that's where I want to basically pick up the story. So this will be the part five of the series on the miracles of the Exodus. And I've subtitled this one, From Light into Darkness. And you'll see what I mean as we get into the sermon today. But let's review just where we left off last time, which was departure from the mountain of God. In Numbers 10, verses 11 and 12... Now it came to pass on the 20th day of the second month, in the second year, the cloud was taken up from the tabernacle of testimony, and the children of Israel set out from the wilderness of Sinai on their journey. Then the cloud settled down in the wilderness of Paran. All right, so here we are. It's pretty much a year now since... Or a little more than a year since they left Egypt, almost a year since they got to the mountain of God, and so they're finally leaving. Now, in Numbers 10, verse 33, so they departed from the mountain of the Lord on a journey of 3 days, and the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord went before them for a 3 days' journey to search a resting place for them. Now, Numbers 10 is kind of giving an overall view here, that they left and they eventually settled down in the wilderness of Paran, as we'll see later on. But here, the first part of this trip, they went 3 days to find a resting place. And look at that a little bit more in just a minute. So we're talking about 1 year, 1 month, and 5 days since leaving Egypt that they finally left the mountain of God and began to head towards the promised land. What did they do all that time? I mean, camping out can be fun. But for a year, what did they do? We have a few details of what they did. We know that they complained a lot. But still, that's a pretty long time. Now, let's look at these calendar dates. I've been showing you kind of a running calendar here. These ones in red are specific dates that are given in the Bible, and they're all counted from the day they left Egypt in the first month. And so we know that they left in the first month on the 15th day, which was the first day of unleavened bread in the evening, and we believe it probably was a Wednesday. That's not an absolute certainty, but we believe that it probably was. And then once we do that, we could start counting down the first Sabbath that occurred, which would have been on the 17th of the first month. That would be the Sabbath that you would start counting the seventh Sabbath and the 50 days, and so we came on down. We do know that after the sixth Sabbath, probably again on a Wednesday, not probably, but they state that they did arrive on at the mountain of God on the same day that they left Egypt. So that would put them around the third month, fourth day of that first year. Then that would put the seventh Sabbath on the seventh day of the third month. And then the next day, Sunday, would be Pentecost, and we believe that that's when God gave the Ten Commandments. We don't know for absolute certainty, but that certainly seems pretty logical. And then we jump down to the first day of the first month and first day of the second year since they left. And the tabernacle was finally set up. So they had took a lot of time. Maybe that's what they did for that 10 months. They constructed the tabernacle. But you'd think they did more than that. And then on the 14th, they observed the Passover. And then the next date we have is the second month, first day of the second year. They took the census. We talked about that census before. And then they left left the mountain of God on the second month, 20th day, which if our days are correct, that would have been a Wednesday. Now, if we look at the, so there's a big gap here from Pentecost to the beginning of the next year. We don't know a lot about what was going on there. But as we read, they traveled 3 days when they first left. If they left on a Wednesday, they traveled on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, then they were probably going to stop for that next Sabbath. Now, whether they were down here in the Sinai or over here in one of the mountains of Midian, they were in rough country. And they weren't going to travel very fast. You've seen pictures that I've shown you of the mountains and the wadis and so forth and the winding way that you'd have to travel. And so they were going to be moving pretty slowly to get out of these mountains. But at least they were heading in the right direction. He goes on to say that after they camped on what was probably a Sabbath, they moved on to Hazeroth, perhaps another Sabbath. And eventually they moved on to Kadesh Barnea, which is in the wilderness of Paran. Now this map shows the wilderness, I don't know whether you can see that or not, but right here, the wilderness of Paran. is this broad general area. And when you look at the maps, you'll see that these things are shifted around from different places. Sometimes they'll show the wilderness of Paran a little further north, a little further east or west, or so forth. But it's this general area that we're talking about here. And, well, let me show you another map here just to refresh your memory, because we talked about this before. Here's the two fingers of the Red Sea. Midian is down here in this area. Then Edom. Then Moab is up in, adjacent to the Dead Sea, on the eastern side of the Dead Sea. And then Ammon. And Ammon wasn't exactly a country. It was a series of tribes, and it's generally referred to as Ammon and the Amalekites. But there were a series of tribes, and we'll talk a little bit more about that, those in a minute. But anyway, now they were heading in the right direction. They were heading towards Canaan, which must have been good news. So let's look at that journey a little bit, and I'm just going to hit the highlights here as we go through this. One of the first things that we read in Numbers 10, verses 13 through 28, is Moses is pretty organized, and he organized the Israelites by tribe, and they marched out and traveled by tribe. So it was a very orderly procession that was going out. Now, another thing Moses did, he asked Jethro's son, Reuel, to act as a guide. That's in Numbers 10, verse 29 through 32. Now, Reuel at first said no. Said no, he wanted to stay and go to his own land in Midian. But then Moses said, look, you come with us, you'll receive the same blessings the Israelites do. And you know this area. You can be a good guide for us. And that's another thing that makes me kind of think that maybe the mountain of God was over in Midian, because he knew that area where they were traveling through. But in any case, it doesn't say for sure whether he accepted or not. Didn't say he didn't. I mean, I kind of just, you kind of assume that he did. But in any case, they were moving on. And immediately, complaints. Numbers 11, verse 1. Now when the people complained, it displeased the Lord, for the Lord heard it, and his anger was aroused, so the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some in the outskirts of the camp. Now they marched in ranks. So you're in pretty good shape if you're in one of those tribes in the middle. But who? What's this outskirts of the camp? Well, if we there was a mixed multitude that was traveling with the Israelites. Apparently, the other slaves from other nations and stuff that were kind of thrown in with the Israelites in Egypt, they were traveling together. And so this mixed multitude seemed to be stirring up things. According to Numbers 10, verse 6, they kind of stirred up the people. We remember the fish which we ate freely in Egypt, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. They started talking, man, do we miss that food from Egypt. That sounds like a Louisiana that's left. the complaints influenced the Israelites. You know, it doesn't say how many were killed by this fire that came down, but it was serious. And it got so serious that Moses started complaining. Now, that's pretty serious when he complains. Numbers 11, verse 11. So Moses said to the Lord, why have you afflicted your servant? And why have I not found favor in your sight, that you have laid the burden of all these people on me? Why me, God? That's what Moses was saying. Now he went on to Moses had some pretty direct conversations with God. You know, he said things like, did I beget them? Where am I going to get the meat from? They won't meet. Where am I going to get the meat from? I can't take it anymore. Just let me die. Just put me out of my misery. That's pretty strong words from Moses. Obviously, the frustrations were getting to him. Little did he know he was going to have to put up with it for another 38 years or so. All right, so how does Moses solve, God solve the problem? Well, he ordains 70 elders. Numbers 11, verse 25, then the Lord came down in the cloud and spoke to him and took of the Spirit that was upon him. And here we see that Moses indeed did have God's Holy Spirit and placed the same upon the 70 elders. And it happened when the Spirit rested upon them, they prophesied, although they never did again. But the prophesying, they were showing the people that the Spirit of God was on them. So they were there to help Moses. Now, by no stretch of the imagination am I implying that whenever a pastor just can't take a congregation anymore, he ordains another elder. That's not why Mr. Lydia was ordained. I can assure you. Mr. St. Lance can still take us some more. We're not there yet. In this case, he needed some, not just help, but some spiritual help. And so God basically gave that Moses Spirit to some of these elders so that they could help. But interestingly, it didn't really help much overall, at least as far as those 70 elders are concerned. None of them made it. Perhaps Joshua and Caleb might have been in that group. But, they all died in the wilderness. So these 70 elders were ordained. And then because they were complaining so much about the quail, God called in the quail in Numbers 11:33. But while the meat was still between their teeth, before it was chewed, the wrath of God was aroused against the people. And the Lord struck the people with a very great plague. They had 30 days of quail. They had more quail than they could eat, and apparently they stuffed themselves until they couldn't stuff themselves anymore. And so, as a result, there was very great plague because God was displeased. And then on top of that, Moses' brother and sister rebelled. This was after they had moved to Hazeroth. Numbers 12, verses 1 and 2. Then Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Ethiopian woman whom he had married, for he had married an Ethiopian woman. So they said, has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also? Now, Aaron was side by side with Moses the whole way. And, of course, you know the result. Miriam suddenly got leprosy, and they had to wait 7 days until God healed her while she was outside the camp. God has a way of getting his point across when you rebel against him, but it didn't seem to make much difference to this group of people, did it? All right, so then they arrive at Kadesh Barnea. Now, we see in Numbers 12:16, and afterwards the people moved from Hazeroth and camped in the wilderness of Paran. So the emphasis here is that they went camping in Paran. But in Deuteronomy 9:23, likewise, when the Lord sent you from Kadesh Barnea, saying, go up and possess the land which I have given you, then you rebelled against the commandment of the Lord your God and did not believe him nor obey him. So where they were actually camped as a jumping off point originally was Kadesh Barnea, which is in they implied then is in the wilderness of Paran. Then Deuteronomy 1:19, so we departed Horeb and went through all the great and terrible wilderness. And notice the description here. That was rough traveling through the wilderness, which you saw on the way to the mountains of the Amorites, as the Lord our God has commanded us. Then we came to Kadesh Barnea. So, Kadesh Barnea is the jumping off point. Numbers 13:26, referring to the spies, came back to Moses and Aaron and all the congregation of the children of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. So that pretty well ties down where Kadesh is, and it's right up there. Near Canaan. I'll show you a little bit more on the map here in just a second. All right, so the spies were sent out for 40 days. That's Numbers 13 and Deuteronomy 1 describes that event. They reported back, quote, saying, they're stronger than we are. That's Numbers 13, 26 through 33 describes the basic report. Of course, only Joshua and Caleb said, let's go get them. How bad was it? How afraid were the Israelites? They wanted a new leader and to return to Egypt. That's discussed in both Numbers 14 and Deuteronomy 1. In discussing these events, it got pretty bad. The crowd wanted to stone Joshua and Caleb. Wanted to stone them. And maybe Moses too. They wanted a new leader. That was pretty bad. That was pretty strong stuff. And so God in Numbers 11, verses 14 through 19, says, let's start over with you, Moses. I'll just kill them all. And here Moses fasted again. 40 days and 40 nights, Moses is fasting. Deuteronomy 9, verses 23 through 27, but I'm going to read verse 23 and 25 here. Likewise, when the Lord sent you from Kadesh Barnea, saying, go up and possess the land which I have given you, then you rebelled against the commandment of the Lord, your God. You did not believe him nor obey his voice. And then verse 25, thus I prostrated myself before the Lord for 40 days and 40 nights. I kept prostrating myself because the Lord had said he would destroy you. Now think about that. That's the third time he's fasted for 40 days. That's 120 days altogether. That's about 6 months. Over about a year or a year and a half or something. That's a lot of fasting. But that just shows Moses' attitude, Moses' concern. It shows why God picked Moses to lead the children of Israel out of Egypt in the first place. All right, so at this point, God gives the sentence, Numbers 14, verses 20 through 23. Then the Lord said, I have pardoned according to your word, but truly as I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of God. Now he throws this in here. He says, truly as I live, all the earth will be filled with the glory of God. And then he continues on to the sentence. Now, this is a prophecy saying, yeah, one day the glory of God will be filled through all the earth. The implication was here that this group of Israelites had experienced the glory of God. From the crossing of the Red Sea to the Ten Commandments to all the miracles. Remember, I mentioned my Bible under the subject of miracles, having some over 20 miracles that occurred through Moses or Aaron during the Exodus. And he says, well, someday the whole world will experience that. But they experienced it then. And because of all these men who have seen my glory and the signs which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness and have put me to the test now these 10 times and have not heeded my voice, they certainly shall not see the land which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who rejected me see it. So, Numbers 14:34. According to the number of days in which you spied out the land, 40 days, for each day you shall bear your guilt 1 year, namely 40 years, and you shall know my rejection. So, the sentence is handed down. Here we get one of these examples of a day for a year that God uses so often. And the first thing that happened is the spies died immediately. That's in Numbers 14, 36, and 37. Well, of course, with the exception of Joshua and Caleb. So a question here at this point that I'll throw out to you. Had not the Israelites' world been filled with the glory of God from the Red Sea to Kadesh Barnea? And yet, why? Why did they not get it? Practically none of them got it. And so the sentence was, none of you are going to make it, at least none of you adults. Now, it said God tested them 10 times some years ago. I gave a sermon on what might have been the 10 tests. This was the list of what I gave at that time. There's some few other things you might have interchanged with some of the things on this list. But certainly their reaction being trapped at the Red Sea, the thirst at Marah, the manna situation in general, including eating Sabbath on the manna, or getting the manna on the Sabbath, complaining at Rephidim, the golden calf was a big one, of course. And these various others, the quail, the Miriam, and Aaron's rebellion, the final straw that broke the camel's back was they refused to go into Canaan. So you may quibble a little bit with the list, but God says there were 10 things that I'm holding you accountable for. Now, let's look at a map here. Here's the Gulf of Aqaba. Here's the Dead Sea up here. Now, you notice I've X'd something out here. You may not be able to see what I X'd out, but what I X'd out is Kadesh Barnea, because there's a little dot right there. This says it's way over here. And the scriptures indicate it's near the border of Eden. So it's more than likely more in this area here. And I've shown you where Mount Or is in the land of Midian, Edom, Moab. and Seir was basically another name for part of Edom. It was all part of Edom. And Mount Seir was another important landmark in the area. So this is where they were, up in here somewhere. Now, what did the Israelites do after they were sentenced? They showed remorse, perhaps, but they didn't show repentance. Deuteronomy 1, verses 43 through 45. So what they did, and Moses is recounting this before they went into the land of Canaan. So I spoke to you, yet you would not listen, but rebelled against the command of the Lord, and presumptuously went up into the mountain, and the Amorites, who dwelt in that mountain, came out against you and chased you as bees do, and drove you back from Seir to Hormah. Then you returned and wept before the Lord, but the Lord would not listen to your voice nor give ear to you. So basically he said, okay, we're sorry. We'll go up, we'll destroy the Amorites, and that will make us even. Well, of course, they couldn't do that without God's help. And they just simply didn't learn their lessons. So what happened next? What happened next? Well, we do know there was Korah's rebellion. And that's it. You might say what happened next was a dark age. The Israelites pretty much disappear from the face of the Bible for the next 38 years, roughly. We know pretty much nothing about what went on other than Korah's rebellion. Now, if you look at the scriptures, and I did this, started looking, well, how much is historical accounting of events and how much is religious stuff, like the laws, the commandments, the statutes, and those kind of things. And I did that by chapters and took the percentage, and it's about 50-50. And that's that's Exodus, Numbers, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy, those four books. It's about 50-50 in terms of the historical part and just the religious aspects. And we did, for the next 38 years, we don't get any information from the Bible. They were just there, somewhere. Now, there's a point in Numbers where they describe a number of places that they camped during that 40-year period. Pretty much none of those, anybody really knows where they are today. So we don't know exactly where they were for those 40 years. They did move around some. But we know nothing much that happened over those next 40 years other than the incident of Korah's rebellion. That's not a whole lot. That's not a whole lot of information. So let's go back to my calendar now, which I'm showing you the first from the first part, first month, 15th day of the first year when they left Egypt. And then we do have some dates here, like the first, excuse me, in the first month, first day of the second year is when they actually set up the tabernacle. That's when they were getting ready to leave. And then on the second month, the 20th day, which is probably a Wednesday, is when they actually left. 3 days later, they rested on the Sabbath. We don't know when they arrived in Kadesh. Got a question mark there. We know they retreated from Kadesh sometime in that second year. You know, when you look at all the things, the travel time, they spent 30 days with the quail incident. Moses was fasted for 40 days in there. The spies were gone 40 days. A lot of time passed in that period of time. I just stuck a number in here just to have something. That maybe around the seventh month or so, seventh, maybe eighth, maybe ninth month, maybe on down near the fall holy days is when they left. And then we have the dark age. And then we could pick it up from there. We do know a couple of things that happened coming out of the dark age. And I want to talk about that here. In the first month, which would be the 40th year now. So like I say, the Bible jumps ahead a lot. They return to Kadesh, and Miriam dies. That's Numbers 20 and verse 1. And it specifically says that Miriam died in the first month of that year, which would be the 39th year after they left. Then on the first month, fifth day of that year, Aaron dies. And they give the specific date, again, counting back from the day they left Egypt as the beginning of the first year. Aaron dies, and they're around the vicinity of Mount Or when Aaron dies, as described in Numbers 33, verse 37 and 38. And then, somewhere in the vicinity, Deuteronomy 2, verse 14, it says they were 38 years from Kadesh to Zered. Okay, that's Kadesh, obviously Kadesh the first time they were there, to Zered on their return trip. Now, if it was exactly 38 years and they left in the seventh month, 02, then 38 years would be the seventh month of year 40. So, we don't know for sure about the month, but it gives us a kind of a general time frame. So, what was going on here? Let me bring up another map. Kind of ignore these numbers. I'm going to replace them with some more in a minute. But this purports to show the trip that the Israelites took to go into Canaan. They were up here in this general area somewhere, around Kadesh Barnea. And at that point, they wanted to take the shortcut across here. But God said, no, we don't want to destroy Edom. So ask them. And Edom said, no, We're not going to let you pass. And so that led them to make this long, circuitous journey around. And now, let's move on here. So, next date that we have specifically, Moses does a review of how they're going to Canaan's entry. That's Deuteronomy 1, verses 1 through 6. So they've moved on around here. They're perched at that point, and we're in the 11th month of that 40th year at this point. Then at some point, Moses dies. That's described in Numbers, Deuteronomy 34. But we don't know the date that he died. We just know that he died and the general location of where he died, Mount Nebo. But then we know on the 110, now we're in 41, which is now coming up on exactly 40 years. The beginning of 41 is going to match when they left, you know, at beginning of year one. And that's when they crossed the Jordan. And that's a specific date. Then we know then that they said they kept the Passover, so that would have been on the 14th at Gilgal. And from what Mr. Lettier was discussing in a sermonette not long ago, that would have been on a Saturday. And then the holy days began the next day, the 15th through the 21st of year 41. So almost to the day, 40 years passed before when they entered Canaan. We don't know for sure whether the walls of Jericho fell during the 7 days and 11 bread. The Bible doesn't specifically say that. Some people assume, some commentators say that they maybe started that marching on the last day of unleavened bread. Josephus is interesting. When Josephus adds things that aren't in the Bible, I'm a little suspect because some of those things don't sound right. But he said they marched around beginning on the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So we don't know for sure, but right around that time is when they conquered Jericho. So that kind of gives you a summary, but I want to go back and look at this in more detail here. We mentioned the Dark Age, but the only thing we know is Korah's rebellion. And then let's look at that last year in some detail. The last year, I mentioned Miriam dies already. I'm going to show you that's where they were, right up here around Kadesh. I'll be putting new numbers in here to correspond with what I'm saying. Moses sins at Meribah, where he struck the rock. That was also in that general area near Kadesh Barnea. Edom refuses to allow passage through the country. That's described in Numbers 20, verses 14 through 21. And this must have been disheartening to them, because now they head the wrong way. They head south. And it appears that what they actually do is go all the way down. You know, they were up in here. They go all the way down to the Gulf of Aqaba again. Now, they say, where are we going here? Doesn't God have a compass? Doesn't he know which way is north? That must have been disheartening to them, because they were there. They were ready to go this time. They had learned their lesson, kind of. And so as they're traveling on this circuitous route around, Aaron dies. Now, he dies near Mount Hor. So Aaron died in this vicinity. And then the Israelites start coming into battle with some kings, King Arad near Mount Hor. I mentioned these tribes, they're generally called Ammon, but there are a bunch of these tribes apparently scattered all around, and this was one of them that attacked, and they were destroyed. That's somewhere in the vicinity of Mount Or. And then they complain about the big detour. That's in Numbers 21, verse 4 through 9. Now, probably that was when they reached the Gulf of Aqaba, when they said, what is going on here? So they complain, naturally. And then they skirted, they went on around, traveled on around, and the reason they were bypassing Edom. So they stayed just enough east, they were out of Edom's territory, and then they come to Moab. And they skirted Moab too. But then they had a problem here. Now, by skirting Moab, they were now in Ammon territory, and they had to go through there. They had to go through there. But they asked the Amorites to let them pass, and the Amorites said no. So they pretty much signed their own death warrant. That's inscribed in Numbers 2, verses 26 and 27. So what happens then? This is a blow-up of the area of Ammon. You can see they show the king of Sion. They show the king of Og. These are specifically mentioned. I suspect, and Basham right up here, I suspect that these are probably a little too far north. They're probably more down in here. But they're in that general area in any case. So they destroy the Ammonites, Sihon, Og, and Bashan, because they refused to let them through. So the only solution was, if you won't let us through, we're coming through. And they did. And then they defeated Moab. Numbers 22 and chapters 22 through 24 describes that in some detail. This, when they defeated Moab, Moab was, up to this point, Moab was still at peace with them. But they were really frightened. And they brought in Balaam to put a curse on them. And so the whole business of Balaam and Balak, that whole business that took up several chapters, describes what happened. So finally, dealing with Moab, they had to defeat them, take them over too. This led to some problems, because after they controlled Moab, naturally, the Israelites start getting into trouble, the harlotry with Moab women, and a plague that killed a pretty large number, 24,000. Sometimes we don't get the numbers. Sometimes God does tell us the numbers. Here he does tell us the numbers, that 24,000. And then Moses died, as we mentioned before. And so, you know, they're right there at this point. They're right there. And then the Israelites crossed the Jordan. And let me show you one more map. Here's the Dead Sea. Here's the Jordan River. You can see Jerusalem over here, Jericho right up in here. This is a modern-day map, so it's not showing all the ancient cities except for Jericho. But Mount Nebo is right over here. This is where Moses went up and viewed the land of Canaan before he died. Now, he was 120 years old. So, you know, he had lived a full life. And so it was time for leadership change. All the old leaders now were dead. And, of course, Joshua then took over, crossed over, and they camped up just a little bit north of Jericho. In Gilead. Now, what I want to do is ask this question to kind of wrap things up here. How many exoduses will there be to the Promised Land? We've been describing the first one. How many will there be? You know, we've got the exodus from Egypt. The date, we believe, is around 1447, maybe 46. Mr. Giese likes that date when he's discussing Joshua and the book of Joshua. But that's certainly the first and a really big one. But how about the exodus from Babylon? It began in 1536 when Cyrus, the Persian king, allowed the Jews to go back to the land of Canaan. And that was an exodus back into the land. That wasn't a big one, but it was certainly a necessary one in terms of the prophecies of God. And then some might say, well, what about the exodus of the Jews to the nation of Israel, beginning in 1948, from countries all over the place, as the state of Israel was started? Because then that's pretty small numbers. I think there's still probably more Jews in New York than there are in Israel. But, you know, that was an exodus. But then there's the big one to come, the exodus after Christ returns. Let's look at that one. It's prophesied in Jeremiah 16, verses 14 and 15. Therefore, behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, that it shall no more be said, the Lord lives who brought you out of the children of Israel from the land of Egypt, but the Lord lives who brought up the children of Israel from the land of the north and from all the lands where he had driven them. For I will bring them back into their land, which I gave to their fathers. Now that sounds like that's going to be a really big one. So big that will make you almost forget the original Exodus. I don't think it'll be completely forgotten, but it might diminish in its standing when it's compared to this final Exodus. Now, the thing is, all of these are physical exoduses. You know, exodus from slavery, persecution, but they're physical. A group of people moving from here to there. But the Bible does talk about some other types of exoduses. Exodus from spiritual slavery and persecution. Let's call them a spiritual exodus. So how many of those are there? Well, there's the New Testament church coming out of the world and into the promised land. That's a pretty long exodus. We're part of it, and it's still going on. But indeed, it is an exodus to the promised land, spiritually. We may not make it in this lifetime, but those who do die in the faith, when Christ returns, where are they going to be? Where are they going to be when they're resurrected? You know, ask this to any church down the street, and they say, oh, up in heaven. The Bible says they're going to be meeting Christ, coming down to the earth in Jerusalem, in Canaan. So that's the ultimate place for the spiritual exodus, the journey that we're on. But that's not the only one. How about the people in the millennium coming out of their former world? Now, that was a physical exodus. But once they get there, they're going to have to kind of do the same thing we're doing now in our spiritual exodus. They're going to have to exit everything that has almost destroyed the world. And certainly, these people that come into Israel in that end time exodus, they're going to be in bad shape. Physically, mentally, emotionally, nearly destroyed. And they've got to come out of all of that. So they've got to come through a spiritual exodus, not much different in many respects from the exodus, the journey that we're on. And then there's a third one, the people of the white throne judgment. Those that never got it, God's going to resurrect them up. And they're going to have to go through a spiritual exodus. Putting aside whatever they were, they're going to have to turn to God and live a life, a godly life, if they want to be in the kingdom. So there's physical exoduses, there's spiritual exoduses. We're on one of those journeys now. But I think it's prudent to probably ask the question, what are the big lessons from the Exodus? Well, that'll be my next sermon.